Our last item for the day is general discussion, and we're going to have Deputy Director lead us off in this area before we open it up on the Tanaway property.
Mr. Vice Chair, this is Joe Storr here. Could I offer up a recommendation? I know there's some interest in the, or if there's interest in the Grays Harbor situation in terms of the north of Falcon and all the issues there on allocation. The director needs to get on the road to Portland for the PFMC meeting, and so he's prepared if commission's interested to talk about that first.
That'd be fine. I wasn't aware that Director Anderson was with us this morning. Go ahead, Phil.
Thanks. And just want to ask first, is there an interest in getting an update on both Grays Harbor and Willapa, or just Grays Harbor?
I think there'd be interest in both.
Okay. Thanks. Good morning, Commissioners. I'm going to start with the Willapa. All of you may remember that we made a significant change in course in terms of the way the Willapa is managed a number of years ago, well, not all that long ago, and that was to attempt to establish a self-sustaining natural population of Chinook, and we chose the Naysale River as the place to do that. And so we've been making changes in our hatchery production between Naysale, Nema, and Willapa Forks Creek Hatchery in response to that change of direction and wanting to ensure that we have a self-sustaining natural population of Chinook. So that is one thing I'd remind you of. The second significant change that we made that was connected to that, and that is the Commission's hatchery and harvest reform policy, and that is largely directed at the implementation of hatchery reform and managing within the context of the recommendations coming out of the Hatchery Scientific Review Group. So in response to that, we have split the bay up into seven different regions. We're managing those regions separately. It relates to trying to increase, in some cases, harvest rates on hatchery fish. In other cases, to protect the areas that the Naysale Chinook migrate through. And then thirdly, to manage the sport commercial harvest opportunity differently in terms of using these different areas. So one of those is areas is called 2T, and 2T is the area, those of you that are familiar with the Willapa, the area that includes what we commonly refer to as Washaway Beach, the area from Tokeland westward as it goes out to the mouth of Grays Harbor, and then east from there to include the area adjacent to North River. And that's the area where there is the primary interest and the primary harvest from the recreational anglers. And so we treat that area in our regulations and our management strategies. So essentially, under the regime that we have in place or we're about to have in place for this year, that area would largely be net free from the middle of August through the middle of September. The other areas, those that are more terminal in nature, like 2U, which is down close to South Bend, and so that area is managed primarily to try to harvest the fish returning to the Forks Creek Hatchery, and then the South Bay area, where we're trying to get at the fish that are originating from the Nema Hatchery. So just to put it in context, a pretty substantial change over the last decade in terms of how we're managing Willapa Bay and our management objectives. So the there's been a number of public meetings over the course of the last 5 weeks or so that have led to a management approach this year, and that the features that I just mentioned. We have some pretty significant returns of fish coming back to the Willapa. That is, we have hatchery Chinook in the amount of 23,000 total, estimated projected to come back. Certainly a lower number of natural Chinook, just short of 5,000. And then on the coho side, we have a hatchery run of coho total. This is total with all three systems of 37,000 hatchery coho. And our natural coho projection is pretty healthy, too, at 58,000. And you may recall that we put essentially a moratorium on any chum-directed fisheries in the Willapa. That's been in place for several years and is going to remain in place for a period of about 10 years. The other thing to keep in mind with respect to Willapa is that there's a lot of Willapa Chinook in particular that are harvested in areas to the north. When we look at a database that went all the way from 1985 through 2001 in terms of coded wire tag recoveries, using that data as a means to estimate the proportion of the Willapa Chinook that are taken in other areas, we have about 25% of the total production is being taken in Alaska and almost 50% being taken off the coast of British Columbia. So you add those two up, it's about 74% being taken in waters north of the border. And then in terms of the amount of the harvest that takes place off the Washington coast in our ocean fisheries, there's the estimate is something just under 2%. So once they start getting close to their river of origin in ocean waters, it appears that they tend to stop biting, which is biting very well, which is characteristic of other far north migrating Chinook stocks. So kind of the bottom line, we have, this net-free zone in the area that's been indicated to us to be most important by the recreational fishery. From the middle of August through the middle of September. If I look at the model in terms of its estimate of total catch, the total catch of Chinook in the sport fishery is estimated at just over 3,000 fish. The total net harvest of Chinook is estimated at 8,000. The majority of those are taken. Let me say about half of those are taken in August up through September 1, and the other half is taken after September 1. And again, when we get into the middle of August and any time after that, those fisheries are being held back into these more terminal areas. Relative to coho, the projected catch for coho in the recreational fishery is just under 1,200, and the estimated catch for the commercial fishery of coho is just a touch over 8,000. We will have significant escapements of hatchery fish, something projected to be something just short of 28,000 fish. And we also are projecting to have an escapement of natural coho that is around 44,000. We're managing the Chinook side to ensure that we don't have an in-river harvest rate on nacelle Chinook that exceeds 30%. And the way this fishery is modeled out, we're at 29.7. So I will stop there before I go on to Grace Harbor.
Questions?
Yeah, Mr. Vice Chair, this is Commissioner Mankin.
Go ahead.
A simple question. I'm sure you've got the answer at your fingertips, Mr. Director, but at one time there was a bright run of coho into the North River, and it's a natural run, as I recall. What's the estimated escapement for that run in with your present scenario?
Well, I have Willapaw and North River are combined in the information that I have in front of me, Commissioner Mankin, so I don't have the ability to break the North River component out right now. When I see you in Portland here in a day or so, I'll try to get that. But when you look at both of those combined, the run size forecast is 39,500. The escapement goals for those two systems is 9,300. And the total number expected to be taken is about 9,000. So about 9,000 out of a harvestable 30,000. So we should be 2.5 times the escapement goal for those two aggregated stocks. So really,
thank you.
I mean, the wild coho in the system in the Willapaw compared to what it was 7-8 years ago has been doing much better.
Good. Thank you very much.
So I'll go to Grace Harbor now. I don't know that it is a more complicated story, but it is a fairly complicated story. And let me first let you know that we do not yet have an agreement with the Quinault Indian Nation on management measures. So what I'm sharing with you is based on an assumption about what the Quinault Nation's fishery would look like, and I shouldn't be making those. I don't mean to be thinking for them or representing them in any way, but I do want you to be aware that what I'm sharing with you is before an agreement with the Quinault Indian Nation is reached. And again, for Grace Harbor Chinook stocks, they also get hit not as hard as Willapaw, but still pretty hard in areas to the north. Again, using that same database that I mentioned before, it's estimated that about 19% of the harvest of Grace Harbor Chinook occurs in Alaska, and just under 30% in waters off British Columbia. So approaching 50% of the numbers that are taken of Grace Harbor origin Chinook stocks are taken north of the border. In terms of stock status, we look at this system and manage the Chehalis system, which has a number of tributaries, Wishkaw and Satsup and others that feed into it, as one part of the system, and then we manage the Humtulip side of the system separately. So the numbers I'm going to share with you are for those two systems. The Chehalis River system, the preseason forecast for Chinook is just over 15,000. The escapement goal is just a touch over 12,300. So you can do the math and see that we have a few harvestable fish, but not a lot. We don't have a lot of hatchery Chinook in the Chehalis side of the system. There is a small amount that is forecast to be at about 1,200 fish. On the coho side, again, sticking with Chehalis, a really strong year, again, forecast for the natural component of coho and Chehalis of 168,000 and some change. And on the hatchery side, 43,000 and some change there. So over 200,000 coho expected to return to the system. And these are after the impacts for coho are calculated in ocean areas. Looking at the Humtulip side, obviously a smaller system, so numbers a lot smaller. But the wild Chinook forecast is 5,269, and hatchery is just a little over 2,700. And on the coho side, for natural fish, touch under 12,000, and for hatchery, just under 25,000. So obviously a lot more coho than there are Chinook to work with. In terms of the non, I'm going to, instead of calling it the state fishery, I'm going to call it the non-Indian fishery. Just in terms of the sectors that we're working with here, we have a segment of the recreational interest that is focused on freshwater opportunity. We have a segment of the recreational fishery that is focused on what we call marine area opportunity, which is that area from essentially Aberdeen on down out through Ostjellens River and in that marine area. We also, of course, have a commercial fishery. And then finally, we have in the non-Indian part of the equation, we have to take into account and consider the Chehalis tribe's catches. There was a case that was adjudicated that went all the way up through the Ninth Circuit Court, and that court determined that the Chehalis tribe's catch comes off the non-treaty share. In terms of seasons, based on, again, this is coming out of a pretty significant, difficult process with stakeholders that's been led by Ron Warren and Kirk Hughes. We do have seasons scheduled, and we did use the Grays Harbor management framework to help guide the outcome. But in terms of the seasons that we're modeling in the marine area, we have a 8-day fishery that allows for a Chinook retention that begins on September 16th and goes through to the 22nd. Obviously, coho opportunity and retentions goes all the way from September 16th on through the end of November. And we're requiring the release of chum. Up in the what I'll call the Chehalis on the freshwater side, there's a season that essentially starts on the 1st of September and goes through the 30th of November. However, in terms of Chinook, we have a one fish bag for Chinook, as we do in the marine area, and it starts October 1 and goes through November 30th. So then on the hump side, a very similar set, starting September 1 through November 30th. However, the Chinook is limited to a one fish bag from September 1 through November 30th. And then for the for our commercial fishery, we have several different days that provide for commercial opportunity. Let me focus the discussion on the ones that are focused on trying to catch coho and are using Chinook essentially as a Chinook release. So unmarked Chinook would not be allowed to be retained. And this year we're using a strategy that includes the use of tangle nets. We have 5 total days of allowance of commercial fishing with tangle nets. We have 1 day that starts the week of September 29th. It's a 12-hour opener, not a typical 1-day 24. We have 2 days the following week. Again, a 12-hour opener. We have 1 day the following week from that. That's a 1-day opener for 12 hours. And then later, 2 weeks later, which puts us at the end of October, we have a 1-day opener that's a 24-hour opener. So now we have a number of specifications that go with the use of the tangle net fishery on these 5 days that include depth restrictions in terms of the net. So what we call the stringers on the net would be 29 feet. We're requiring short soak times, and I believe the short soak time will be limited to 45 minutes. And then we'll require the recovery boxes, and those recovery boxes will need to be operational and functioning when the net is in the water and as they're retrieving the net. We're also going to have 3 to 4 staff deployed on the commercial boats during these openings. We're going to be trying to assess the condition of the Chinook that are released and make at least a qualitative assessment of release mortality. Now, in terms of release mortality, during the use of the tangle nets, we're using a value of 14.7%. That value comes from the work that was done on the Columbia River with spring Chinook using tangle nets. There was a concern about differences in water temperature. We looked at the water temperature readings that we have for the area from Hoquiam downstream and compared that to the water temperatures that were present when the study was done in the Columbia and found, I believe, to be about a 1 degree of centigrade difference, so it's something just right around 2 degrees Fahrenheit difference. If we were using a typical gill net and we had a Chinook release required, we'd be assessing a 45% release mortality rate instead of the 14.7 that I just referenced. And to give you an idea of the magnitude of the difference of those two release mortality rates applied to the 5-day fishery that we have planned, with a 14.7 release mortality, we anticipate mortality of 77 Chinook, and with the 45%, it would be 231. So there's a difference of about 154 fish that we're dealing here with between those using those two different mortality rates. In terms of the catch expectations, we expect or anticipate that 16% of the Chinook, and I'm going to say harvest, but in this case it would be release, would be occurring in the commercial fishery. So that 77 fish that I mentioned, and I got to double check my number here just to be sure, but because there's a few hatchery fish that are incorporated in that 16.1% number. So, but just in general terms, about 16% of the Chinook mortalities, both retained and released, would be in the commercial fishery. About 25% of the Chinook mortalities would be in the sport marine area, so out there in front of Johns River and up to Hoquiam, that area, about 25%. And with the schedule that we have that I mentioned, about 50 or just right under 60% of the catch would be occurring in freshwater sport. And that's an aggregate number. Those are aggregate percentages that I'm giving you for both the Chehalis and the Hump Tulips side. On the coho side, the projected outcome is about 40% to be in the commercial fishery. And obviously that's the reason we're looking at this tangle net approach, is to try to get at some of those very abundant coho stocks. So about just under 40% in the commercial fishery, about 12% in the sport marine area, and just over 48% of the total coho catch we're estimating to be caught in the freshwater sport fishery. So that's an overview of the management plan that we have and have been working with industry on. We understand that, we understand that not everybody is fully supportive of either the Willapa or the Grace Harbor plan. I think it was probably one of the most difficult preseason planning processes that we've had for both of these areas, particularly Grays Harbor. I wouldn't be surprised if we don't also hear some concerns expressed by coastal legislators that may have concerns about how the proportion of the catch that's being allotted to the commercial fishery in the Grays Harbor. So that's my best attempt to summarize where we are, and I'd be happy to try to answer any questions.
Questions from the commission?
Mr. Vice Chair.
Go ahead.
This is Commissioner Perry. Phil, some years ago we talked about, or at least it was presented to the commission, some ideas on how to reduce the amount of catch of these fish off of the off of British Columbia, off of Vancouver Island, and so forth. And there was a number of ideas talked about. Are those still in play, or has there been anything worked out with the Canadians in terms of taking those fish?
Thanks, Commissioner Perry. You may recall that there was a renegotiation of what we refer to as the Chinook Annex, which is part of the Pacific Salmon Commission and the Pacific Salmon Treaty. And that renegotiation was concluded and went into effect in 2008. And as part of that, we changed the approach that we used to limit the impact on Washington and Oregon origin Chinook in both British Columbia and Alaska. And we used what's called an aggregate abundance index. And so the as the name suggests, the Chinook stocks are aggregated, and then there's an exploitation rate ceiling, or there's an exploitation rate applied, and that exploitation rate varies dependent on the overall abundance, the aggregate abundance of the stocks. So then that's in place for 10 years, so that's going through 2018. And that was a significant step forward from a Washington-Oregon perspective in that it reduced the impact on Washington and Oregon origin stocks by, I believe it was 15% in Canada and 15% in Alaska. So certainly didn't eliminate them, but it reduced them from what it was prior to that time. So we made a step forward. That won't be up for, well, unfortunately, it's getting closer all the time, but we will renegotiate that annex and continue our efforts to try to reduce the interceptions of Washington origin Chinook process.
Mr. Vice Chair, Commissioner.
Thank you.
Commissioner Carpenter.
If I might add to what Phil said, and Phil can correct me if I'm out of line on this at all, but part of that, Commissioner Perry, was a significant amount of money provided by the U.S. government to Canada for a commercial buyback program, and I can't tell you how many vessels that affected, but I think that's where the savings came from. Phil, do I have that right? And then I have three questions for you on Grays Harbor.
Commissioner Carpenter, the money that the U.S. government has been providing to the Canadian government, I believe they were going to use that for a buyback. Well, I know they were, and again, as you indicate, I'm not sure how they're progressing with that. And there was also a substantial amount of money provided to the state of Alaska for their reduction in their catch as well. And they're not using it for a buyback, to the best of my knowledge.
If I may, Bill, three quick questions on your Grays Harbor presentation. Is there consideration during those commercial fisheries there that the treaty and non-treaty fleets fish on the same day? I'll put all three questions on the table, and you can address them at your convenience. Second question, is the gillnet fishery takes place in Grays Harbor a day or nighttime or both activity based on having the appropriate observers on board that you mentioned? And is there any perspective that the tribes might use tangle nets in this fishery?
Maybe I'll start with the last question first. I don't believe, and I would be surprised if there are any plans by the Quinault Nation to use tangle nets in their fishery. Quinaults, of course, will be using gill nets to access their share, so they'll be fishing more days than the five that we are. I would not think that the tribal fishery and the state fishery will occur on the same day. And with regard to day versus nighttime, I'm going to hold answering that question for you until I see you to make absolutely certain of that I'm correct on my answer. Obviously, the one day that's 24 hours is both day and night, but as to those other four, I want to double-check just to be certain I'm correct.
Okay, thank you. One other follow-up, if I may. What type of impacts historically have there been on sturgeon in that area? And is there a model? Is there a piece in the model that speaks to that based on our concerns for sturgeon?
I don't have that data in front of me. I don't think, particularly when we're going to be using tangle nets that are limited to a net depth of 29 feet, that there's going to be a concern for sturgeon.
Okay, thank you.
The data is available. I just don't have it at my fingertips.
Fair enough. Thank you, Phil.
Mr. Vice Chair.
Mr. Wecker.
Yes. Thanks, Phil. Really terrific explanation of pretty complicated fishery. Controversial, certainly. We've received a tremendous amount of public input, petitions, comments. I believe there's a lawsuit that has been filed. So I wanted to explore a couple of what I think are the most serious allegations that we've heard so far about the Grays Harbor plan, the Grays Harbor agreement. And that is, in some of these were presented in a letter by Francis Estalila and a few of his associates. And they point out that we have badly underestimated the power of various fisheries, so that the predictions that you are laying out are potentially underestimates of what will actually be killed. And so can you respond to this, to that claim that we are almost willfully underestimating? Because the allegation is that this happens year after year, that we chronically underestimate the number of dead fish that will be produced by each of these fisheries. So and we are not meeting our escapement of natural fish, wild fish, year after year. So could you address that? And then I have another follow-up.
Well, first of all, I haven't seen Francis' letter. It hasn't been provided to me. And so I would like an opportunity to look at the allegations that are being made and have an opportunity to provide a thoughtful response rather than trying to do it in this setting.
Okay. Fair enough.
I think I can categorically say without hesitation hesitation that we're not willfully modeling numbers of mortalities in non-Indian fisheries that are underestimating what we believe will occur in the fishery. Now, we all know that these run forecasts vary, and that as those run forecasts return and become reality, that the numbers of fish taken are going to change, because these are fixed schedules, both in the recreational and commercial fisheries. So if the run size is bigger, there's going to be more catch. If it's smaller, there will likely be less catch. And the other response, and I won't go any farther, the other two responses are, the Chehalis side of the stock in particular, well, both sides, but Chehalis in particular, from the escapement perspective, we have fallen short of meeting our preseason expectations of escapement, and in addition, we've fallen short of the actual numbers that escape have been less than we forecast. So this is a chronic problem. It bounces around, but there's no denying that we have not been meeting our escapement objective. Chinook, I know that Ron has been talking with the constituents about that, I think short of making some putting, and maybe the appropriate thing will be to put some significant buffers on the projection and manage for the buffered number. Obviously, we would need to get the Quinault Indian Nation to agree to that in order to have it attain its full effect. And then the last thing is on the lawsuit. You're correct. We've had a lawsuit, and I've had a chance to take a brief look at it. The AGs are looking at it, and I don't really want to comment on it in this forum because it is obviously a sensitive matter, and we want to get a full understanding of the implications of the loss and how we go about responding.
Okay, thanks for that. And I didn't realize that you had not seen that letter, so we'll make sure that you do receive it. We are trying to make sure that everything that comes into the commission office does get directed to the director's office, too. So I apologize for that. You made the statement, Phil, that you will have some observers on the opening day of the use of tangle nets.
We're planning to have
those. Sorry. Yeah, can you explain a little bit more who those people will be? Are they going to be looking for compliance?
Hi, Commissioner Jennings. Just needs to jump in real quick. I'm sorry, I've got a schedule conflict and need to step away from the call. So, just want to let you know that I will be signing off. Thank you.
Thanks, Commissioner Jennings.
Just real quick, Commissioner. At this point, recognizing that we're just put this plan together here within the last few days, we are intending to have 3 to 4 observers every opening, not just the opener, and with the principal purpose of making observations of the fish that are released, the number that are maybe going to a recovery box, and the overall success of the fishery. And with the idea that if we see something through those observations that suggests that the release mortality is lower than what we think, i.e. we have a greater number than 15% of the fish that we believe are dying as a result of being entangled, that we would be in a position to make in-season changes to the fishery to respond to those observations.
Okay. Thanks very much for that.
Okay. I'm going to run. I've got to try to get to Portland here soon.
Thank you, Director Anderson. We appreciate you staying and enlightening us on that. We will now proceed, and Deputy Director Joe Storer, you want to give us a brief update on the Tenaway property?
Yes, Commissioners. Again, Joe Storer here. I will try to be very brief here. What I'm trying to do is set up really a discussion that we can have at the end of next week around the Tenaway and the Yakima Basin Integrated Water Plan. So you have material that you received this morning. You have kind of a policy paper that I put together based on a conversation that I had with the chair and the vice chair on Monday, and then a couple of background pieces that give you a good sense of the overall Yakima Basin plan and, in particular, the Tenaway purchase. In a nutshell, the Yakima Basin plan came together when, after years of a lot of frustration around water and concern about climate change impacts on irrigation especially, you had irrigators, cities, the Yakima Nation, conservation groups, and state agencies all getting together and looking at each other in the eye and saying, we're going to advance all these causes and needs together in unison instead of fighting with each other. So they've got a plan in place that over about 30 years would cost around $4 billion to fund, capital dollars. And this is the first year that the first ask of the legislature is this year to begin that 30-year process. And a key piece of that first package is the acquisition of about 50,000 acres in the Tenaway watershed. The reason that's very prominent at the very beginning is we've had a landowner, it was originally Boise Cascade land that was then purchased by a man out of New York, kind of a venture capitalist, and we've been talking to him for probably 15 years about his willingness to sell, not just us, but a number of groups. And originally, he was asking around $300 million for this. And for a number of reasons, we've come to an agreement with him that he'd be willing to sell that for about $97 million. So that pushed it towards the front of the pack in terms of this Yakima plan, along with some four different ideas on water storage and a number of projects to improve fish passage. So all of those are packaged up and sitting in front of the legislature now. And what I'm concerned with, and the reason I wrote this, put this policy paper together, is how do we honor and respect the commission's role in terms of approving land acquisition and the things we do as an agency in the midst of this huge snowball that's building and all the discussions that are occurring around it. Haven't seen the House or the Capitol budgets yet, but Governor Inslee's budget had about $45 million in the Capitol budget that would be split three ways between those three different interests: fish passage, land acquisition for the conservation side, and water supply for the irrigators in the cities. We're expecting the capital budget to have a very different approach. They are at least talking to us about appropriating about $130 million and purchasing the Tenaway all at once up front instead of successive biennia of payments that would be made under the House version, or under, I'm sorry, Governor Inslee's version. Not sure what the House is going to do. So I laid all of that out in these three documents I sent you. There's a lot more detail there. There's some sense of how we would look at acquisition. And the proposal in the policy paper that I'm making is that you delegate the authority for final approval to the director. And that just primarily has to do with the rapid pace and the lack of control that that we have here at the agency, I think, over how this decision is going to get made. and I've got some principles laid out in terms of how we would look at approval and all of that. So if you could take a look at that, then we can have the discussion next Friday as to any questions you might have about that plan and this Tianaway proposal, and then some, you know, consideration of whether you want to delegate that authority for a fairly major acquisition to the director. And if not, then we can, you know, talk about how else you need to be involved or want to be involved. Any questions? Does that make sense?
Yeah, thanks, Joe.
Yeah. We'll continue the conversations at our meeting next week. Any other general discussion items from the commission or from staff?
Mr. Vice Chair.
Commissioner Perry.
Excuse me. Yeah, I just wanted to say one thing, that on March 27th, which was a week and a half ago, I guess, or so, I attended a meeting in Colville in which the department discussed basically the relationship of trying to count big game and potential wolf impacts on deer, elk, and moose, and so forth. I have some other comments on that and so forth, but I think I'll save those for the Wildlife Committee meeting. I just wanted to indicate that I had attended it. It was a very well attended meeting. There was at least 250 people there, probably more, standing room only in a very large room. And high interest by the group. Department put on a quite a long presentation on some of the facts and problems that they're having with big game counting and wolf impacts. But I think I'll reserve any additional comments until the Wildlife Committee meeting. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Perry. Commissioner Caney, did you have a comment?
Yes.
Do you mind to make?
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. Just a real quick update on the hour and a half of the meeting today that I was able to attend of the four county commissioners. I don't know what they're calling it, quorum, I believe. And the bottom line is the issue that they were talking while I was there was wolf, and it was particularly that the bill on the lethal take for caught in the act didn't pass, and very upset about that, and then basically discussing their options, what to do next. And quite a large contingent felt they were just going to, you know, lean towards this declaration of emergency and take it into their own hands. Their counsel, who was present, seemed to offer some good advice in that unless you really do have a state of emergency, that's, you can do that in one way that's just a political statement, but another way that actually puts you at risk as a county for several different reasons. And so they were just going over ideas and ways to possibly get this ability now that the bill hasn't passed. And as I understand the bill, it was to direct the Fish and Wildlife Commission to set rules for cognac lethal take, you know, beyond what we have now. And, you know, as just someone in the audience, I wasn't about to make any suggestions, but I do have a question, I guess, for our commission in that I know, and there was actually some very good suggestions came up about public outreach and just get more people to know, you know, what are potential problems. You know, there are certain county commissioners that really felt kids are going to be vanishing from bus stops, and they need cages around them. So there's really a lot of hyper excitement about all of it, and yet there were some calm suggestions being made, like the education component. And also, one of the county commissioners suggested that they really focus in on the wolf plan itself, and, you know, are there any abilities to change it now that it's been passed? And what was going through my mind was, as I understand it, if it's minor changes, I believe Director Anderson has talked about this in the past, if there's minor changes, that's something the commission can take up, because it was never meant to be locked in. But any major changes to the plan would have to be, run through a whole public process. And so I guess what was in my thoughts, and I don't know if they'll come to this or not, but it was, well, if there's enough evidence and facts and proof that the Cotton Knee Act lethal take could be run maybe for a year trial or whatever, and if there's enough evidence that showed it would not have a huge impact on wolf recovery, would it be possible for the Fish and Wildlife Commission to take it up, even though the legislation hasn't passed a law telling us to do that? Could we look at it that way and then, based on the merits of the material presented, decide if there was something that could be done so that these groups of county commissioners from many counties now, and it sounds like they have at least 18 counties ready to kind of go on the warpath, I guess, is it something the commission could take up? And I'm going to leave that as a question. And then also that they were very upset enough that they feel maybe one of the ways to be heard is when these bills don't pass is to start using their whatever legislative clout they have to take away legislative money from the Department of Wildlife. So they're really considering fairly big and outrageous and maybe yet some thoughts that have merit as well. So that's, I had to leave it and the discussion wasn't over. But I guess I would ask that as a question. Is that something that the Wildlife Commission, even though not directed by the legislature, could have brought before? And we analyze it on the merits of its facts and its evidence and see if there's some tweak that could be done to the wolf plan.
Commissioner,
I'm asking that.
Commissioner Dubia?
Yes, Commissioner Deputy Director Storr, I think it is.
Yes, it is. Thank you. Commissioner Caney, we've had that question in front of us, and we're looking at it, and I believe there is going to be some discussion about that at the Wildlife Committee meeting next week.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah.
Sitting with that many county commissioners that are very, very upset, you know, you take to heart what they're saying, and you of course, in all cases, you're trying to understand their position and see if there's a possibility of working through it.
There's a comment we'll make is that when we adopted the plan, at numerous points, tried to emphasize that the plan was adaptive and that the wolf plan has lots of dynamics to it, and that we would be willing to look at and consider amending the plan appropriately and when we can. So I think that's the question. We'll start with the Wildlife Committee, and then we'll expand it from there and get everybody's input in terms of how far can we go before we have to do a public process to amend it or so forth. But I think it's time long enough, and certainly in those counties, we're beyond wolf recovery. We're past all our objectives. We're into wolf management plan now, so we got to start thinking about what we're doing there, even though we haven't formally developed a wolf management plan yet.
I think that would be good.
And we'll begin that process at the next wildlife meeting. One thing that concerns me about that is that there is a pretty strong, I think, commitment from those 18 counties, certainly from seven of them that I'm familiar with, that they think their only way to get the department's attention is to stop our funding. And I think we really need that funding to do some things that's necessary. It also benefits them. So I think we need to start looking at that and reaching out immediately to find out how we can get their support instead of their detriment to our current legislative issues we want passed.
Well, Commissioner Dubia, this is Joe. You know, we heard that a lot from various legislators during the course of the session, and we would remind them that we had, in fact, supported Representative Kret's bill, and you know, the tension is very high on this issue in general, and then with the House and the Senate controlled by different parties, we're in the middle again on this one. So at the end of the day, it doesn't look like any of that manifested itself, but not to say it couldn't happen in the future.
Yeah. Any other comments, questions, additions? Hearing none, it's 1224, April 5th, 2013. I will adjourn the Fish and Wildlife conference call for the Commission for the State of Washington. Thanks, gentlemen and ladies, and we'll see each other next week.
Yep.
Thank you.
Have a good weekend.
Bye. Thank you.